And because his immediate personal problem will have been solved, he will be the one to tell our people, look how much progress we're making. I'm in Washington, D.C. I can have tea in the White House. I'm your spokesman. I'm your, you know, your leader. While our people are still living in Harlem in the slums, still receiving the worst form of education and the worst facilities in which to try and educate our children. This is the device that they will use. They'll make a black cabinet member. I read that's one of the gimmicks that they got going. But will it work? Can that one whom they are going to put down there step into the fire and put it out when the flames begin to leap up? When people take to the streets in their explosive move, will that one that they're going to put in the cabinet be able to go among those people? Or they'll burn him faster than they burn the ones who've been in. When people take to the streets in their explosive move, will that one that they're going to put in the cabinet be able to go among those people? Or they'll burn him faster than they burn the ones who've been in. At the international level in 1964, up until 1964 and through 1964, the device that they use, they send well-chosen black representatives to the African continent, whose mission it was to make the people on that continent think that all of our problems had been solved. They went over there as apologists. I saw some of them, trailed some of them, saw the results that some of them had left there. But their prime mission was to go into Africa, which is a most vital country to the United States interests. So these Toms, you're not supposed to call them Toms nowadays, they're sue you. So these uncles were sent over there. Don't bother the man. He's doing his job. He's gonna put you on TV so you can get investigated. So these Toms don't go to Africa actually because they want to explore or learn something for themselves, broaden their scope, or communicate between between their people and our people over there. But they go primarily to represent the United States government. And when they go, they gloss things over. They tell how well we're doing here, how the Civil Rights Bill has settled everything, and how the Nobel Peace Prize was handed down. Oh yes, that's how they tell it. Actually, they succeed in widening the gap between the Afro-American and the African. The image that they leave there of the Afro-American is so obnoxious that the African ends up not wanting to identify with it or be related to it. And it is only when the nationalist-minded, African nationalist-minded, or black-minded Afro-American goes abroad to the African continent and establishes direct lines of communication and lets the African brothers over there know what is happening over here and know that our people are not so dumb that we are blind to our true mission and position in this structure, then the Africans begin to understand us and identify with us and sympathize with our problems, and to the point where they are willing to make whatever sacrifice necessary to see that their long lost brothers get a better break than we've been getting up to now. On the national scale during 1964, as I just mentioned, politically, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party had its face slashed at Atlantic City at a convention over which Lyndon B. Johnson was the boss and Hubert Humphrey was the next boss, and Mayor Wagner had a lot of influence himself. Still, none of that influence was shown in any way whatsoever when the hopes and aspirations of the people, the black people of Mississippi, were at stake. Though at the beginning of 64 we were told that our political rights would be broadened, it was in 1964 that the two white civil rights workers working with the black civil rights worker was murdered. And the only thing that they were doing was trying to help the black people of Mississippi learn how to register. This is all. This is their crime. They were trying to show our people in Mississippi how to become registered voters. This was their crime. This was the reason for which they were murdered. And the most pitiful part about them being murdered was the civil rights organizations themselves being so chicken when it comes to reacting in a way that they should have reacted to the murder of these three civil rights workers. The civil rights groups sold those three brothers out. Sold them out. Sold them right down the river because they died, and what has been done about it? And what voice is being raised every day today in regards to the murder of those three civil rights workers? It has been forgotten. You hear nothing else about it. And the only time it comes up is when J. Edgar Hoover calls one of the Negro leaders a liar. And then another argument starts in motion, and they then ask, what about the brothers who got murdered? But when it comes to the murder itself, it's forgotten, gone by, glossed over, and nothing has been done about it. So this is why I say, if we get involved in the civil rights movement and go to Mississippi or any place else to help our people get registered to vote, we intend to go prepared. We don't intend to break the law. Because when you're trying to register to vote, you're upholding the law. It's the one who tries to prevent you from registering to vote who's breaking the law. And you got a right. You got a right to protect yourself by any means necessary. And if the government doesn't want civil rights groups going equipped, the government should do its job. Concerning the Harlem incident that took place during the summer, when the citizens of Harlem were attacked, in a pogrom, how do you pronounce that word? Pogrom? Pogrom, that's what it was. I was reading about it over, see, I can't pronounce it, because it's not my word. But when the people of Harlem were the victims of that pogrom, that's your word. During the summer, we had heard long before it took place that it was going to take place. We had gotten the word that there were elements in the power structure that were going to incite a riot, something in Harlem that they could call a riot, in order that they could step in and be justified in using whatever measures necessary to crush the militant groups, which were still considered in the embryonic stage, and realizing that there was a plan afoot to instigate something in Harlem so they could step in and crush it. There were elements in Harlem who were prepared and qualified and equipped to retaliate in situations like that, who purposely did not get involved. And the real miracle of the Harlem explosion was the restraint exercised by the people of Harlem. The miracle of 1964, I tell it to you straight, the miracle of 1964, during the incidents that took place in Harlem, was the restraint exercised by the people in Harlem who are qualified and equipped and whatever else there is to protect themselves when they are being illegally and immorally and unjustly attacked. And an illegal attack, an unjust attack, and an immoral attack does not have, can be made against you by anyone. Just because a person has on a uniform does not give him the right to come and shoot up your neighborhood. No, this is not right. And my suggestion would be that as long as the police department doesn't use those methods in white neighborhoods, they shouldn't come to Harlem and use it in our neighborhoods. I wasn't here. I'm glad I wasn't here, because I'd be dead. They'd have to kill me. I'd rather be dead than to let someone walk around my house or in my neighborhood shooting it up where my children are in the line of fire. Either they die or I die. It's not intelligent. And it all started when a little boy was shot by a policeman. And he was turned loose, the same as the sheriff was turned loose in Mississippi when he killed three civil rights workers. I'm almost ending. I'm just taking my time tonight because I'm overworked. And I'm taking my time. I'm taking my time. I'm not hurrying up, I mean. I hope that you don't misunderstand me when I say that, and I'm not advocating anything illegal against the police. I know good policemen, and I know bad policemen. I know policemen that bend over backwards to be human, and to protect other humans, and to treat people as if they are human beings. Then I know others who shouldn't be on force. They're not qualified morally, either even mentally. Some of them not even psychologically, to be on the force. Well, those kind I don't go for. But those who can pass the test, they're all right. We don't include them with the rest. While millions of our people are starving in this country, this government is spending billions of dollars abroad to feed other people. They're sending wheat over to Russia, in Poland, some of those other places, and dumping a lot of it in the ocean to keep the market down while people are starving. This is something that doesn't add up. How are you going to have peace in 1965 and you are hungry, no job, welfare workers won't even work? And you read where they're dumping. Why, you go on the rampage. You think they're out of their mind. In 1964, we had still with us the slumlords. People who own the houses but don't live there themselves. Usually they live up around the Grand Concourse or somewhere. They contribute to the NAACP, and CORE, and all the civil rights organizations. Give you money to go out and picket, and they own the house that you're picketing. And this bad housing conditions that continue to exist up there, they keep our people the victims of health problems. High infant and adult mortality rate is higher in Harlem than any other part of the country or part of the city. They promised us jobs and gave us welfare checks instead. We're still jobless. We're still unemployed. The welfare is taking care of us, making us beggars, robbing us of our dignity, of our manhood. So that I point out that in 1964, it was not a pie-in-the-sky year of promises, as was promised in January of that year. Blood did flow in the streets of Harlem, Philadelphia, Rochester, some places over here in Jersey, and elsewhere. In 1965, even more blood will flow. More than you ever dreamt. It'll flow downtown as well as uptown. Why? Why will it flow? Have the causes that forced it to flow in 65 or 64 been removed? Have the causes that made it flow in 63 been removed? The causes are still there. How can you sit around and naively, in such a naive way, and make yourself think that things are getting better when the causes that created the bad conditions still remain? The only one whose problem is solved is the leader. They get the peace prize, while the people have no peace. Or as he himself said, while he's up on the mountain, the people are in the valley. I'm gonna tell you why it's gonna flow. And then bring my little talk to a close. In 1964, 97% of the black American voters supported Lyndon B. Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, and the Democratic Party. 97%. No one minority group in the history of the world has ever given so much of its uncompromising support to one candidate and one party in the history of the world. No one people, no one group has ever gone all the way to support a party and its candidate as did the people, the black people in America in 1964. Look how many people voted for Goldwater. Over 26 million. Why, when you deduct the non-white people from the total white population, you'll find out that white people were almost evenly divided between Goldwater and Johnson. Yes! Go get the total number of voters in this country and find out how many of them are white. Deduct the non-whites, the Puerto Ricans, and the Negroes, and the others, and you'll find out that white people didn't support Johnson like they want to brag that they did. The non-whites won for him 97%. And the first act of the Democratic Party, Lyndon B. included, in 1965, when the representatives from the state of Mississippi, who refused to support Johnson, came to Washington, D.C., and the black people of Mississippi sent representatives there to challenge the legality of these people being seated, what did Johnson say? Nothing.
What did Humphrey say? Nothing. What did Robert Pretty Boy Kennedy say? Nothing. Nothing. Not one thing. These are the people that black people have supported. This is the party that they have supported. Where were they when the black man needed them last couple days ago in Washington, D.C.? They were where they always are, twiddling their thumbs someplace in the pool room or in the gallery. So black people in 1964 will not be controlled by these Uncle Tom leaders. You believe it? They won't be held in jail. They won't be held on the plantation by these overseers. They won't be held in the corral. They won't be held back at all. The frustration of these black representatives from Mississippi when they arrived in Washington, D.C. the other day, thinking, you know, that the great society was going to include them, only to see the door closed in their face like that. That's what makes them think. That's what makes them realize what they're up against. It is this type of frustration that produced the Mau Mau. They reached a point where they saw it takes power to talk to power. It takes power to make power respected. It takes madness almost to deal with a power structure that's so corrupt. So corrupt. But in 1965, we should see a lot of action. Since the old methods haven't worked, they'll be forced to try new methods. If you read the article in this week's U.S. News and World Report, which is not the best magazine in the world, where it does tell, though, that the Big Six, they call themselves the Big Six, the leaders of the black community who have been endorsed by the white community, the Big Six, they themselves are turning to Africa. Dr. King, Farmer, all of them are admitting that the problem of the black man in America is inseparable from the problem of the African. Dr. King and Mr. Farmer and the others, Roy included, Uncle Roy, are admitting that the problem of that the black man cannot get dignity in America until the black man has dignity on the mother continent. They're admitting this. They're admitting that the roots of the black man in America are still in Africa. They're admitting this. I was shocked to see them admit so much, so soon, so publicly. I was shocked to see that they will say in public what they've always agreed to in private. I was shocked. But it shows that they themselves are undertaking a revolutionary approach to the problem. They're beginning to see that the problem of the black man in America no longer is a Negro problem or an American problem. It's a world problem. When they begin to identify our struggle with the struggle of the brothers on the mother continent, then these Big Six, Uncle Roy, are seeing the necessity of internationalizing the problem. Now, either they have to deny it or confirm it. But I don't think this magazine would say all what it has said and quote them too. Here it has Dr. King saying, there is a growing willingness among U.S. Negroes to identify with the Africans. There is a sense of pride as American Negroes see positions of importance in the United Nations, accorded courtesies which American Negroes are not accustomed to receiving in their own country. Dr. King talked. He was up on the mountain. And they're beginning to see that the only way the black man in this country will ever get any solution to his problem, it will have to be a solution which the government in Washington has no hand in. Because the government can't solve the problem. The government consists of crackers from Mississippi and Georgia and Alabama and Arkansas. and Texas. For they are beginning to see that it is not we who should be taking our problem to Washington, but it is we who should be taking Washington to the United Nations. It is not we who have committed the crime. It is not we who have committed the crime. It is our government that has committed the crime. Our government has failed to protect our lives, to protect our property, to give us proper education. It has failed to even give us the proper facilities for education. It has failed to house us. It has failed, as the men there in the book up in Boston, when they dumped all the tea in the sea, taxation without representation has got to go. So I say in my conclusion, to read from another newspaper, many of you say, well, would we have the right to take the problem of the black man in this country before the UN? I say yes, because here it says, this is in the Post a couple days ago, the Post is a New York paper, represents itself as liberal, which is a misrepresentation. It says, House asked to condemn Soviet treatment of Jews. Representative Halpern of Queens urged the House today to condemn what he termed the odious and discriminatory treatment of the Jewish community in the Soviet Union. He drafted resolutions for introduction that would condemn Russia for the persecution of Jews, and placed the House on record as favoring continued American efforts to obtain through the UN world condemnation and prohibition of anti-Semitism in treaty form. Soviet policy, Halpern said in a prepared speech, involves a premeditated effort to stamp out Jewish culture and religion. It is a deliberate policy, but also a secretive one. If this representative voted into office, probably by many people sitting right here, can go to Washington, D.C. and get that House, that governmental body, to stick its nose in what's happening to 3 million people all the way on the other side of the world, and have that government brought into the United Nations and condemned for its abuse of the rights of those 3 million people, I say that the 22 million black people in this country are justified and within our rights as our brothers on the African continent to take this government into the United Nations and protect us.